Item five, review of report on liquidity subportfolio. Price.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a portion of our annual process of reviewing each one of the subportfolios, reminding the trustees what they're doing for us, how they're structured, what the performance has been. This is the second year we've been doing these deeper reviews. I know the liquidity subportfolio tends to be the most operational and simple in nature, and so we probably have a briefer conversation here. But I'd just like to highlight for the trustees again what the program does for Sisera and what how it's performed and what the changes have been recently. The short answer is it's a very stable program. Everything's performing in line with expectations. And we're going to have a chat about some of the details here. At the conclusion of my presentation, I am going to have DFA present to the board in terms of highlighting what their role is in the program. This is, again, every time we do one of these portfolio reviews, we bring in one of the managers to highlight their particular role in there so the trustees are reminded about who's working for us and what they're doing for us. And then just pulling up the presentation here. So if you take a look at slide one here, and my apologies, my packet is not loading. All right, we're going to run off memory here for a moment. Not loading. Thank you. Karen's insistence on hard copy is saving me here. take a look at slide two, it actually is here. Slide three. The number is very, very small. Just a reminder, the liquidity program really is the anchor piece of the FFP portfolio construction process. It's where we house 4 years of benefit payments. Every year we refresh it, we draw it down for 11 months, and then we come back in and use the actuarial models to top that back up here. So this has been up and running for a couple of years now. We refresh it every July in conjunction with the employer prepayments just to minimize cash flows here. But this is really intended to be highly operational in nature. And the reason we think it's important in this portfolio construction process is it relieves the liquidity pressure on the remainder of the portfolio. We're not tapping the rest of the growth portfolio or the diversified portfolio on a regular basis. We're tapping that once or twice a year at most. And that way we can have far lower trading activity and not be in a position to be a forced seller in a period of stress. And that's really the big takeaway there. If you take a look at slide five, again, test my vision here. Take a look at slide five. This is our functional assessment of how it's performing. We set individual measures of success for each one of the sub-portfolios. For the liquidity program, our measures of success are going to come down to credit quality, portfolio duration, and number of months of benefits available to be dispersed from this. You'll see here the assessment as of 12/31/18. We are running at a quality level of single A plus, so investment grade is running a little bit lower than it was last year, but this is still in line with expectations. The duration is running about 2.1 years, where our range on duration typically goes from about 2 to 2.5 years, if we took a look at those average duration of those 4 years of benefit payments that are in there. And we had 43 months of benefit payments invested as of the end of the year. So you recall, this gets funded in July, ratchets down. So we'll ratchet down to the 37-month mark and refresh it the next July. Given that it is short-term in nature, that leads to relatively low yields. The current yield of the portfolio is running about 3%. And just so the trustees have the context here, total performance net of fees for the liquidity program in 2018 was 1.7%. Total performance for in 2017 was 1.4%. So we are seeing that total fund come up a little bit net of fees, but understand the short duration nature of this, and in today's fixed income environment leads to low yields, and so there's an opportunity cost associated with this that we intend to make up on the growth portfolio. If you turn to slide six, The manager structure is a multi-manager structure. This is the common theme here is, again, everybody has to meet the high quality, low duration strategies. But we wanted to build out a complementary structure where each manager was bringing a unique view of the market into the portfolio. So SIT is the portfolio is probably the most different from its peers here. This is high quality mortgages, government-backed mortgages. They're very well seasoned. And so these are mortgages that have rates of 6-7%. They should have been refied, but they have low balances. So they tend not to be refied. They are available in the marketplace, but they are something, we're usually in year 25 of a 30-year mortgage pool. DFA, who will present later on today, is a very quantitatively oriented firm that takes a view of they can manufacture characteristics across the market by piecing together individual bonds. They don't necessarily need to look at individual bonds on a standalone basis. They're looking at building an aggregate of the credit quality they want, the liquidity they want. They have a different way of looking at the marketplace that tends to lead to a little bit more liquid approach, which is something that was important to us. And then Insight is the completion manager. So Insight takes a look at the cash that will be delivered from SIT, the cash that will be delivered from DFA, and the actuarial model, and they build a portfolio to bridge that gap there. So SIT runs about a quarter of the program when fully funded, DFA another quarter, and SIT the remaining half, roughly speaking. If you take a look at slide 7, just touch on the credit quality or the portfolio characteristics there. And maybe I'll just highlight changes since the last time we reviewed this, and they're not many. As I said, the manager structure was put in place in late 2016, so we've got 2 years plus of experience here. The big changes, and these are the notable changes, not big changes, are we've increased the cash flow from the SIT portfolio from about $750,000 a month to about $1.25 million based upon what was available in the marketplace. Essentially, we're getting better yields off what we're buying today. With Insight, the credit quality has declined slightly from AA minus to single A plus. It's one tick down, still in line with what the portfolio is allowed to do, and it's basically a reflection of where the market opportunity set was in their estimation. And DFA, the most significant change over the past year has been a reduction in the duration from about 2.9 years last time we looked at this to 2.5 years. Not big change. I mean, these are very stable platforms here. Each one of the managers is highlighted on the following slides, but again, given the lack of changes here, I'm just going to say that the SIT characteristics have remained highly consistent. We had one personnel change in terms of the leader of the fixed income group, and I do not know what the whistling noise is. So we had the leader of the fixed income group retire at the end of last year, but it didn't impact our team. The team is really led by Bryce Doty with Mark Book and Chris Rasmussen backing him up. That's been consistent for the better part of a decade now. We did increase their AUM slightly in the last annual funding plan that we funded in July. I think it came from 485 up to about $530 million. And as a result, we've been able to get more cash flow coming off this portfolio. DFA, likewise, has remained very stable here. We've increased their cash flow slightly, but again, in line with the model's expectations. If you take a look at the cash flow that we expect from DFA, it ratchets up about $3 to $4 million per year, and so we just kind of have that on a long-term ratcheting model there. And then Insight, again, no changes on the portfolio team per se. They had a change in an individual left the firm who was more on the modeling side but not on the portfolio management side. We're going to meet with a replacement in the near future here, but characteristics remain the same. They've been right in line with expectations on the actuarial model. Maybe we'll just touch on cash flow on slide 12 here. And just to remind the trustees about when we talk about the annual funding plan, when we talk about the drawdown, here's the timing of this. As I said earlier, the employer prepayments come in late July. We do bulk of our rebalancing and the annual funding plan. I'm sorry, I'm on slide 12. Bulk of our rebalancing and the annual funding plan implementation in August, and so we're going to handle any of the asset allocation changes that we highlight earlier in the year. You recall about a month ago we talked about some minor changes around real estate targets, and we'll have to be topping up the program with the next fourth year tranche of benefit payments using the actuarial models. The other thing to note is because we are funding this according to an actuarial model, we want to see that that actually works. It's worked very well. We're typically within less than $1 million difference on our actual experience versus our actuarial model, so it's a very tight fit. And you recall that on slide 13, the board input into this process really comes down to setting the size. The board selected the 4 years of benefit payments in reserve. We highlighted some other options for the trustees. This is what the feedback was. We wanted 4 years of benefit payments in reserve. That decision was made in 2015, so we're going to be due to revisit that probably next year and see if that's still the number of years that you want in reserve there, because that does dictate how we build the rest of the portfolio. The other thing that the trustees can get involved in is we can use this portfolio, we can use essentially that last fourth year or one of those years to do rebalancing into the equity markets if there's a extraordinary dislocation to the market. Can't do the equity market big enough to trigger that conversation since we've had this in place. So this would be a down 20% kind of scenario or greater. And thankfully, we just haven't had that. So we haven't had that conversation. It's called the Zone 2 rebalancing. We haven't had that conversation with the trustees because we haven't seen that market opportunity set develop. So again, this is a brief overview, but it is the most operational. It's portion of the overall program. It has the fewest moving pieces. I'd say the takeaways from my perspective is we're operating in line with our expectations. The measures of success are showing up right where we'd expect them to. I think in the grand scheme of things, we'd like the yield to be higher, but we're recognizing that that's simply not available in the marketplace given the short-term nature of the program. And we're not recommending any changes to the multi-manager structure at this point in time.
Just wanted to get your reaction on, I think when we started this, interest rates set by the Fed at the low end were basically 0 to 0.25. Most of the impression I got was that normal was going to be somewhere in the 3 to 4% range at the 10-year level. We got up to where we are today, about halfway, and they've stopped. Have we won or lost? As contrasted to what they might have done, and my sense was they were going to do and didn't.
Yeah, I think I think the time frame for interest rate rises is extended well beyond what our original expectations were in 2015. We looked at this and said, I don't think we necessarily made a call on, is this going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years? The decision was not tactical in nature. We weren't saying we're going to take our duration or our fixed income portfolio down by half based upon a view that that interest rates were going to rise. We took the duration down by half because we changed the function of the fixed income portfolio to be cash matched to our benefit payment profile. So it really was more of a strategic decision that we thought might benefit from market moves as well. And you're right, I think the rates have stayed lower for longer than was the consensus at the time and was my belief at the time. But my forecasting crystal ball is as cloudy as everybody else's when it comes to central bank actions. And certainly post-global financial crisis, the central bank's willingness to intervene in the market has been much more significant than prior. And I think kind of the globally coordinated nature of central bank actions for much of the past decade has been unprecedented in modern central bank history. So, if interest rates were to rise another several percent, would we benefit? Yeah. we would. But if that doesn't happen, I think we're getting a decent yield. We're getting a 3% yield off this portion of the portfolio today. That's, I think when we built the portfolio in 2016, we were down in the low 2% range, and I think we're, based on the February numbers, we're like 3.25-ish yield on this portfolio. So certainly we're seeing a trend in the upward direction. It just hasn't been terribly significant.
My sense is if we had called exactly what in fact took place, we would have taken the same path.
I think so.
The same place.
Okay. It would be an interesting question to say, would we have done this when the rates were at 8% and in decline? And I don't know. I think it would have been, that would have been a more difficult conversation, but I think given the rates were near historic lows, we thought, certainly, I thought the chance of an upward movement was greater than an additional downward movement. And, you know, thankfully the U.S. has not experienced negative rates, unlike some of our peers in Europe. Yeah.
For that.
On 7, looking at the relevant statistics with SIT, it looks like higher credit quality with higher coupon payment.
Yeah.
Why don't we emphasize that more?
The coupon payment?
I mean, sure. Why don't we have more invested in SIT versus...
So the coupon payment is kind of the absolute level of yield on the portfolio, on the individual bonds that they're buying, but you're buying them at a higher price. So your yield is actually commensurate with your peers. So if it's a 6% yield, you're paying a higher price, so your yield portion there is more in line with peers. And we should probably add a yield line there just to highlight that. They're buying something different, but they're buying it at a higher price. Therefore, the net yield that we're getting is...
Pretty even across the
it's
three.
Still a little bit higher than the other two portfolios, but not as big of an outlier as what you're seeing here.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions from the trustees before we ask DFA to give their expertise on what's going on with the bond market and how exciting it is?
Well, don't keep us in suspense.
All right. In suspense. So Ted Simpson and Dave Plecka are here from DFA.
All yours.
Thanks, Tim.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, well, thanks everyone for inviting us in this morning, and certainly thank you for the relationship that you've had with Dimensional since the end of 2016. In fact, good place to begin. I think everyone does have somewhere in a, has something that looks just like what I have here. Good. If you flip over to page 2, you can see that it was in December of 2016 that Dimensional started managing one portion of your liquidity portfolio, as Tim just set out broadly there. You can see that as of the end of March, the balance in that portfolio is about $375 million. And you can see the performance there. That's gross of about a 10 basis point fee that we charge you. That's since inception about 40 basis points over the benchmark. So with that, again, Ted Simpson, I'm your relationship manager. Hopefully you recognize me, those of you who make the Sackers and things like that. Joined by Dave Plecka, who's the head of our fixed income portfolio management team and has been running that team for a couple dozen years.
Almost 30 years.
Yeah. certainly I'll just spend just another minute or two giving you a quick update on Dimensional, but then turning it over to Dave. Tim had mentioned maybe a half hour, give or take, of prepared remarks, if that still works, but certainly, and then maybe even a few more minutes for questions, but please don't hesitate to jump in with questions all throughout. Certainly I'll make this time as useful for you as it can be. This is a double-sided presentation, so if you look just on the page 3 there, a couple just updates I want to point out. at least from the upcoming events. I know David has been able to join us for some events, and I want to point out one that's coming up in September, middle of September, down in Santa Monica, a one-day event. And hopefully David can share with you that it's our events are, we hope to be very educational, a lot of academic style presentations, usually about the types of topics that that relate to the way we see the world, but typically not just kind of telling you about the funds we run and trying to sell you other things. We also have an event coming up just in a couple weeks. That's our annual symposium out in Charlotte, and Greg is planning on joining us for that. Unfortunately, it's the same week as Sackers, so you'll see me kind of starting late Wednesday night in Tahoe, those of you who are going to make it, but I'll be out there with Greg the first couple days of the week. And then in terms of, well, probably an easier place to see some of the updates on facts and figures about the firm, if we flip over to page six, you know, Dimensional, I guess, been around for 37 years, founded in the early 1980s. So a firm that, you know, has been around for a while, is at $576 billion in assets, not the largest money manager out there by any stretch, but a sizable, stable firm. We have up over 1,400 employees, most of whom are in the United States or are in our Texas, Austin, Texas headquarters. Still a little over 100 of us up from in Santa Monica, where Dave and I are up from. And then that Charlotte office, where we're going to just opened our own building there last month after 3 years of being in the area. We've got a couple hundred employees there as well. And then do have less germane to the U.S. only strategy we manage for you, but we do have offices around the world, London, Sydney, and East Asia as well. The last thing I'll really kind of touch on here is the one investment philosophy. Dave will jump into that a little bit more deeply, but at a high level, trying to remember, you know, kind of who Dimensional is. We're the firm that is constructing portfolios for our clients, trying to beat the markets, but doing so without having to rely on our ability to outguess markets. And so specifically, what does that mean? It means that we rely kind of solely on what's known and observable in current market prices as a best estimate for the value, you know, today's value of securities, as well as to give us insights into the differences of expected returns amongst different types of securities, using theoretical and empirical research that Dave will get into a little bit more deeply. But that's the way to kind of remember Dimensional, and that's why hopefully we play a nice role within your portfolio, because that's taking that very much just kind of what's known and observable does make Dimensional a little bit of a unique approach, and also, as Tim mentioned, very broadly diversified within our portfolio, which gives us a fair amount of liquidity and ability to generate, the even through transactions, the cash flows that you need monthly for your portfolio. Hopefully, if you remember from those of you remember from even presenting when we presented to you a couple years ago in your finals, very much driven by connection to the academic community. Some of the faces you can see here on page seven on the left, some of the consultants who are very much involved with the firm, as well as a couple notable past and current board members on the right. And then the very last thing I'm going to touch on is the team, senior executive team on page eight. Just a quick update there. Well, I guess first of all, I would say that both at the senior management level as well as the fixed income team level that Dave will touch on in just a second, very much a team-based. I mean, Dave is a star, in my opinion, but Dimensional is very much the antithesis of a star manager approach. Dave will highlight we really haven't had any changes on that team, fixed income team, which has that team-based process-driven approach. We did have one thing I wanted to highlight that I had shared with Tim just within the last month or two. If you look at the head of our portfolio management on the bottom half of page eight, Jed Fogdahl is now our single head of portfolio management. Up until a couple months ago, we had Joe Chi as his co-head. Joe still remains with the firm, kind of in a 50% in the office, 50% out, but had some family considerations, which I'm very proud of the firm for allowing him to kind of stay with the firm in a role that works for him, but one that has him more in an advisory role right now and not kind of the co-head. What that allowed us to do was to bring up kind of three deputy heads, strong, deep bench there, but they now help Jed to kind of oversee how does this impact the particular portfolio we manage for you. Not really much at all, but in terms of checking the box and saying, yep, got the update on what's going on at Dimensional. That's one of the few things that we've had going on in the last couple of years. Well, with that, if there's no questions about Dimensional as a firm, I'm going to turn it over to Dave to talk a little bit about Dimensional's kind of overall approach to fixed income, our platform, our team, but then really to spend more of the time to jump in to remind those of you who were able to see us when we presented here a couple of years ago about Dimensional's view on markets, going deeper into what I laid out there at a high level, and then certainly talk about how that both theoretical and empirical research-driven view on markets and the how that results in a pretty unique ability to implement in markets, how that's resulted in terms of recent performance for your portfolio.
Okay.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, thank you. Moving on to page 9. I'll be brief on the next couple pages, sort of overview pages, but just a quick summary of our fixed income. Dimensional started managing fixed income in 1983. We started out on the very, very short end of the curve, running an ultra-short strategy with very, very, very high credit quality. And over the next 36 years, it's been this slow and steady evolution across farther out the term dimension and farther down the credit dimension, and then globally around the world. There's essentially, I describe it as kind of three threads of that evolution going on, you know, simultaneously. One is the evolving nature of our clients and their needs and their portfolio needs. Another was certainly an evolving research. So research. Today, what we know about capital markets, what we know about the fixed income markets is far beyond what we would have known 36 years ago, and that's going to continue. The researchers throughout academia are never going to say, okay, we got it all figured out, so we can stop now. They will continue, of course, to do that. And also the evolution of markets and market structures, and particularly in market transparency, has evolved quite a bit. What we can see now, actual transactions, this post-trade transparency that opened up to the markets in the early 2000s, it continues to evolve around the world. It's been led to lots of evolution across, and now we're essentially sort of a full-service fixed income portfolio management shop that can essentially touch all the major parts of the market. On page 10, again, just a quick review of the team. Ted and Tim both pointed out, very stable team. And it is a team-based approach. If there were stars at Dimensional, I would point to the page of the academics. Our strategy is based on work originally done by Professor Eugene Fama. And literally that he started poking around in the bond markets in the mid-70s and has been studying markets since him and many, many others, of course. But essentially our role as portfolio managers is essentially to implement the strategy. So we have a research group that will be continuing to look at markets and continue to look at the research. We have an investment committee that essentially will design the portfolio, ultimately set the constraints for what we're allowed to do. And then the portfolio management team, we're the implementers. We go and make that happen. And essentially, all our desks around the world, we use the same sets of systems. If one of us got hit by a bus, I hope none of us get hit by a bus, but if something happened to one, each portfolio has a primary and a backup, but we are all using the same systems. We're all looking at the same markets the same way. We're all generating this, looking at the same sets of expected returns. So it's not, there's no key man risk, as they'd say, where we're not depending on one person's ability to forecast interest rates. The strategy is not a rate forecasting strategy. And as Ted pointed out, we often use the line that price is the hero of our story. We observe market prices, and there is a tremendous amount of information about expected return and about risk that you could derive from the current market price. So with that, I will just jump a review of the philosophy, and then, of course, we'll get into the characteristics and the returns of the portfolio itself. But we talk about four kind of main pillars on page 12 here, ultimately the decisions you make about these four will ultimately drive the results that you get. So we'll just go quickly through these four, and then we'll do a deep dive into each of them. So first is duration. That's a fairly obvious one. I mean, whether you're holding a portfolio of very short-term T-bills or long-term bonds, you're going to ultimately have very, very different results. It's obviously one of the key drivers in fixed income. We call that the term risk, how much term risk you're willing to take. Of course, for the portfolio we manage for you, the maximum allowed portfolio duration would be 3 years. And any individual security, we would buy nothing with a maturity greater than 5 years. So 5 years and under on all the securities, 3 year maximum duration on the overall portfolio average. Credit quality is obviously another one. Main driver of expected returns. We would argue, we see many, many factor models, as they're called. People will test, they will run models with a dozen different factors. And we study them all. And what we find is once you take into account term and credit, there's very, very little left over. These are the main explainers of what your results are going to be, where you'll line up on the term dimension and how you line up on the credit dimension. So for your portfolio, it is investment grade portfolio, so every security has to be BBB minus or above. That's the lower edge of investment grade, BBB minus. And the average credit quality has to be no lower than single A minus. And as you saw earlier, the average credit quality is a little higher than that. We're single A plus. But so it'll be investment grade for any security. Average has to be single A minus or greater. Currency of issuance, in this case, is very simple. It's all going to be denominated in U.S. dollars. Many investors will hold other types of strategies, but in this case, 100% U.S. dollars. And then in the end, it's how you implement, will matter. And I'll give you an example. We know, every month we have a known outflow, cash outflow of $13 million, roughly, about that. So you'd say, well, if I know these outflows, well, one approach would be, why don't I line up bonds that mature on those outflows? And that would save me a transactions cost by just letting the bond mature, and then I have the cash proceeds. So that's one implementation approach, but those bonds may not be where you'd want to be, but it'll save you a transactions cost. Another approach might say, well, why don't I put the bonds where I want to be and then face a transactions cost to meet this outflow? Now there's a trade-off. Well, I'm more where I want to be, but now I have a cost to generate the cash flow. And that would be an example of an implementation question. How do you choose to implement that? Just to remind, our approach is to hold broadly diversified portfolios of highly liquid securities. Our approach is to say, let's be where we want to be, and let's manage these transaction costs in a way where we could meet the outflows and still keep transaction costs very, very low, and even net of those transactions be better off than putting these bonds in a place where it might not necessarily be the highest expected return over that holding period. So we'll do a little deeper dive into that as well. Okay, so on to page 13, this is how we would evaluate the term decision. And generally, what FAMA showed and many other academics have showed, expected returns are largely driven, along that dimension, by the shape of the yield curve. So, the yield curve is showing you could look at yields across different maturities. Mostly, we think about the yield curve as being upwardly sloped, that longer maturities have higher yields than shorter maturities. But it's not always that way. We happen to be in a fairly flat yield curve right now, that if you literally looked at the yield of a 2-year bond, for example, and a 5-year bond, they're virtually identical. If you look at the yield of a 10-year bond, it's a few basis points higher, but not much. So we have a very flat curve. Sometimes the curve gets inverted, where yields on longer bonds have lower yields than shorter bonds. And FAMA showed that is the main driver of what you should expect to earn. And basically, his result turns out to be fairly intuitive, that on average, when yield curves are upwardly sloped, you expect to do better by holding longer versus shorter. When yield curves are flat, you have no expectation that you'll do better by extending out to hold longer bonds when the yields are basically the same as shorter bonds. We know that the volatility of bonds goes up as you go out. That will always be the case. So our view is that if the expected return is the same, but the volatility is higher, we're not willing to go out. We will not extend out in flat curves. And Tim talked a little bit about our duration shortening, and that will be 100% driven by this flattening yield curve. As the yield curve has been flattening, we've been less and less willing to be near our upper range of what we're allowed to be, and we're seeing the duration of our portfolio shorten. What we show on page 13 is a quick sort of demonstration of that. The squiggly blue line on the top part of the graph, that's what we call a term spread. Very, very simple. All it is, we're looking at the yield of an intermediate portfolio of government bonds minus the yield of a short-term portfolio. So it's just a quick proxy for the shape of the curve. When the curve is upwardly sloped, the term spread is positive. When the curve is flat, the term spread is zero because the yields are the same. And when the yield curve is inverted, the term spread is actually negative. So we show what the term spread has been. You go to the far right, it's close to zero now because it's a very flat curve. These spreads are observable for all market participants. We can all look at the yield curve. So what this test does, it says, let's look at the term spread at the start of the period each month, and then let's go to the end of the period and see what the live returns turned out to be. And what you'll find is, on average, the actual total returns in periods of steep upwardly sloped curves are higher for taking more term risk than they are in flat curves. So just to read the numbers quickly, over all the periods, on average, the intermediate government bonds outperformed the short-term government bonds. This is a monthly number, 6 basis points a month. So about 72 basis points a year, that's what you got for being intermediate government versus short government. If you focus only on the periods where the term spread was at least 25 basis points, that increment went from 72 a year to 96 a year, eight a month. And if you look at periods of very steep curves, it's 15 basis points per month or 180 basis points a year. So we do see that relationship that your actual total returns tend to be higher out the curve in upwardly sloped curves than you see in flat curves. And so that page 14 basically just describes what we do. In upwardly sloped curves, we'll move more towards the farther end of our allowable range. In flat or inverted curves, we'll move towards the shorter end of our allowable range. Is that any questions on that? Okay, very good. So the credit's very similar. We could observe credit spreads through time. We just simply look at the yield difference between a corporate portfolio and a government portfolio, and that difference in yields is the credit spread. The credit spread ebbs and flows through time. We showed that's the top graph. And on average, we ask, okay, how much do we earn in the end? Because markets move. What is our realized credit premium? What do we get to keep? And again, a very intuitive result. On average, when credit spreads are wide, you realize a greater credit premium. When credit spreads are low, you realize a smaller credit premium. And that's shown in the numbers just the same way on page 15, that overall, the average credit premium is about 6 basis points a month. So investment grade intermediate corporates do about 72 basis points more than intermediate governments. That's the credit spread, the realized credit premium. But when credit spreads get higher, realized premiums get higher. So how does that affect our portfolio? We look at page 16. Basically what we do, if you look at, let's start with the panel on the right. When credit spreads are wide, that's when we'll tilt more towards those single A's and triple B's. That's because the expected premium is higher. When credit spreads get narrow, we're just not as willing to take as much single A and triple B credit risk when the expected premium is much lower. So we will tilt away from those single A's and triple B's. And it never goes to zero, and it never gets above market weight in those single A's and triple B's, but we will vary the tilts towards the what we call the lower tier credit as a function of the expected credit premium. And page 17 is just a quick cheat sheet for you that says upwardly sloped curves or flat curves, wide credit spreads, lower credit spreads, and this is ultimately how our portfolios will look. So it's a very transparent process because yield curves and credit spreads are publicly available and observable by all. So it should be no surprise that when you see a flatter curve and narrower credit spreads like we're in now, that you would see the duration shortening and then the credit quality actually tilting more towards the AAAs and AAs. So that's a quick run through on the philosophy, and this ultimately is what we're implementing for your portfolio. On page 19, just the idea now about how do we go implement this thing. What we find, and again after 3.5 decades or more of doing this, what we find is that the most powerful position I think you put your trader, when the trader goes to implement and says, I'm going to go execute a trade, the most powerful position you could put that trader in is give them the ability to walk away from any trade. In other words, they're negotiating. It's like buying a house. You know, if you go in and you say, I'm going to own this house, well, you sort of have limited bargaining power. You're going to end up buying the house. But if you say, look, I'm willing to buy it at this price, but I'm willing to walk away and go find another, you're in a much more powerful position to bargain. And that's what our traders, what we try to do. So that, you know, if every order that went from a portfolio manager to a trader had to get executed, the other side figures that out. They figure, yeah, they're playing hardball now, but they'll cave because they always do. So what we do is we hold big, broad portfolios with lots and lots of substitutes that the portfolio manager, there's many different opportunities if he needs to sell a bond, he or she needs to sell a bond, that they could pick from. They will try one and send an order to a trader. The trader will try it. They might say, look, I'm not liking the price I'm getting here. We say, okay, fine, cancel that one. I'll give you another one. That level of substitutability is what really gives us our trading advantage. So what we're showing here is that we know our portfolio, we know every expected return of every bond, we could rank order by expected return. We have the lower expected return bonds are potential sells, the higher expected return bonds are potential buys. We look to always increase the expected return of the portfolio within the guidelines. And we give our traders many different candidates for which to go execute. Some get executed, some don't. Feeds back into the portfolio, and every day the process starts again. Finally, we're on page 20 and 21, we're talking about how we monitor the credits. I said earlier there's a tremendous amount of information that's embedded in the price of a bond about the credit of the bond. Although many, we analyze on the order of 40,000 trades a day that's coming from these public databases are known as TRACE that FINRA started in the early 2000s. We could actually see transactions now, which we couldn't prior to 2002. Within 15 minutes of the trade actually happening, has been a tremendous change in our market. And what we look for is these bonds that have sort of outlier credit spreads. Bonds that, in this case, you say, if you look on page 20, we see a bond that when we get in the left-hand part of the graph, the blue dots are where it's trading and its credit spread. You can see the bonds clustered around, let's say, when you get to the early part of 2011, trading around a triple B. But the rating agencies still call it a single A. So you think to yourself, all right, what do we have going on here? It's a single A-rated bond, but when I look at the actual prices in the marketplace, it looks a lot more like the yields of triple B bonds. And ultimately, you'll find yourself at a fork in the road. You're going to decide one way or another on this. One fork says, I think I found a bargain. This bond is rated single A, but I get all this extra yield. It's yielding like a triple B, and maybe the market's got the price wrong, and I should go buy that bond because it's undervalued. The other fork that you'll go down is the market is pricing it like a triple B because it actually is a triple B, and the rating agencies haven't caught up yet with the market. And that's the path we're going to take every time. When we look at those outliers and say, the market's probably got the price right, and the rating agencies haven't caught up. And if you look at those blue dots going left to right, you'll see, this is one example, we've seen it across the whole collective universe of data, that on average, the market gets there first. And then the rating agency catches up several weeks later. So we're doing this 40,000 times a day, every day. Every bond in your portfolio and all our portfolios gets assigned an internal rating based on how the market is pricing that. We go off that internal rating. And then finally, I have to put 21, just a quick page, talk on our transactions cost analysis. On average, if we just say, for example, the upper right panel, the corporate bonds, this would be affecting you the most. That blue diamond is, on average, is where we're buying the bond. That's in price terms where we're buying it. The dots to the left and right, that's the average price of the exact same security on the trade just prior to our trade and the trade just after our trade. That's in the TRACE data sequence. We could identify our trade. We just look at the trade right before ours and right after ours. On average, we're buying bonds somewhere from 13 basis points on average below in price than the fellow that traded just prior to us, and 9 basis points lower in price than the trade right after us. And then on the sells, we're able to trade on average 5 or 6 basis points higher than the adjacent trades in the sequence. And we think that's due to the flexibility that we give our traders. They could play hardball, and if they don't like the level, they say, fine, nothing done, cancel that, and we get them a substitute.
So these figures are for the strategy in general?
Yes, for all of our corporate trades across the entire firm in the prior year.
Can you talk about our portfolio in the context of turning over a third of it annually? and how that affects or how that integrates with the kind of liquidity provider philosophy.
Well, ultimately, the strategy is not necessarily one that's buy and hold to maturity. So what we will do is when we look at a security, let's say we look at a three-year bond, we'd say holding it to its maturity is one of our alternatives, and we'll certainly evaluate that. And you would just use the yield to maturity as your proxy there for expected return. But then we would look at other potential holding periods as well. So what about if we only held it for 1 year? Now yield, it does factor into the expected return, but other things factor in as well. And we'll evaluate a whole host of expected returns for different holding periods. So even in the absence of the the cash flow needs, there may be a turnover rate because we're saying we want to buy that three-year bond, hold it for a year, sell it, and then take the proceeds back out to 3 years again. So instead of three down to zero, let's work three down to two. And we have to take into account the transaction's cost because you will have to trade, you know, the bond. Now, as far as meeting the cash flow needs, it's you know, similar thing that you know, we generally have the portfolio where we think the best place to be on the curve. We understand that there are outflows. We know that we get plenty of advance notice. We know the whole pattern. But we're confident that we're better off having the portfolio where we want. And then when we choose to which bonds to sell to meet the cash outflows, we will pick from a set of candidates that is in the region of the curve that we want to sell. But it's not any one of them may or may not get done. And we're able to maintain these very low transactions costs by doing it that way. And we think net-net we're better off than saying, well, yeah, you know, I know the three-year spot's where I want to be, but I have an outflow in 3 months, so let's just buy a three-month bond. We're better off over the next 3 months, for example. And we do have plenty of bonds, by the way, on the short end as well, but we're better off putting the portfolio where we want and executing the portfolio that way, and then meeting the flows, you know, with potential transactions. Okay, so just to, on page 23, it's going to be a quick reminder of the guidelines, and I think we've pretty much covered all of them, 3 years duration and 5 years maturity and the credit quality, all U.S. dollar-denominated bonds. And then as far as the characteristics of the portfolio, you could see on page 24, you could start to see that as you go to, let's say, mid-2018, all of a sudden this sort of downward trend in the average duration of the portfolio. In fact, the duration as of March 31 was down to 2.31 years. And again, it's because of a very flattening curve. Like I say, going from doing these extension trades from 2 to 5 basically to nothing because the curve is so flat, we're unwilling to do those trades. Not willing to take more volatility unless we get an incremental amount of expected premium for doing so. So I think that's, Tim mentioned it, and I agree, that's probably the story of the year is that little downward trend. And we'll see some other pictures in a second here. On page 25, it's a nice snapshot along three different dimensions here. The credit quality, the distribution by maturity is the middle one, and then the sector on the bottom one. If you're starting from the top, not much really meaningfully different from where we were a year ago. I mean, they're not, the numbers aren't identical, but close enough. I think the story is in that middle one. And I'll just highlight some of these numbers for you. So this is going to be the distribution by maturity tranche. So if you look at, let's say, the two darkest green segments to the left, that's the 0 to 1 year and 1 to 2 year. Where we are now, so these are the shortest part of the portfolio. Where we are now is a little under 35% of the portfolio is now 2 year and under. If you look at 12 months ago, it was a little over 21%. So that's a fairly big increase. And then if you go to the far right, the lightest shade green, that's what we have in the 4 to 5 year. That's our longest allowable tranche. You know, right now we're at 3.4%. A year ago it was at 22.3%. So you see the portfolio starting to get shorter. You know, we're not in the business of forecasting changes in rates. We look at the current curve and we say, where's the best place to be? If the curve does continue to stay flat, you would expect to see these things to get continually shorter. When the July inflow comes, most of that is likely to get invested in the 2 year and under, the very the shortest part. But I've been at it for a long time. Every day you go to work, the yield curve's a little bit different. So where it is in July, who knows? You know, it's a little bit steeper now than it was, let's say, a month or two ago. But generally, a pretty flat curve. And then again, the bottom one, distribution by sector type, really nothing meaningful as far as changes. And then Ted covered, at least from inception, the returns, and we could look at the year-to-date, the trailing 1 year, on page 26. Year-to-date, by the way, if you look at it from inception, you know, our average annual outperformance of the benchmark is 40 basis points. Year-to-date, now this is 3 months into the year, and we're 41 up, so I think you could describe the first quarter as a very, very positive quarter for the portfolio, given that essentially 40 basis points in a three-month period is quite successful. And then we show the year-over-year, or the annual, calendar annuals down at the bottom. So outperformed in 2017, slightly underperformed in 2018.
Please, Jerry.
Could you touch just a little bit on corporate, what the corporate mix is? Roughly, how many corporate entities are there in a basket? Secondly, multi-part question, I guess. Are you focused in some examples of some of the corporate bonds that are in there? Are you totally focused on yield, or do you take into consideration segments? Are you agnostic when it comes to market?
Okay, so first one, as far as the number of unique issuers, it would be something on the order of a portfolio of this size would be something on the order of 200 or north of 200 different issuers. So any one issuer is going to be, you know, very, very small one. And by the way, the limits that we'd allow per issuer is a function of the credit. So if it's a AAA or AA, if it's an Apple, we would be able to go all the way up to 3%. But if it's a triple B, there's a triple B issuer, we would not go over 1% in that. So how much we would allow. But those would be at, you know, the most. But in reality, we're going to be spread out over a couple hundred different names. As far as you know, do we have a sector, what some would call like a sector rotation that right. We like? Gee, we really like industrials. There is none of that in the strategy. Ultimately, we will look at expected returns as sort of embedded in the current price. Now we won't allow the portfolio to concentrate along industry lines. So we do have maximums per industry. To be very, very technical and specific, we do use the Bloomberg Barclays industry category. It's technically category 3, but we would not allow more than 25% in any one broad industry. But we're not you know, trying to forecast that we think industrials would do better than utilities, or within industrials that consumer cyclicals will do better than autos or something like that. We're going to use the current price to drive expected return.
So it's basically agnostic.
Agnostic to the sector.
On the sector. So give us an example of some of the ones that are in the basket.
Oh, I mean, it would be, you know, virtually all the common household names, you know, Johnson & Johnson or Apple. Those would, you know, be on the high end of allowable. Some that, I'll give you one that we wouldn't buy right now is Ford Motor, for example. Now, Ford Motor is rated triple B, so technically, still eligible, and I don't know why I'm picking on Ford. I was born in Dearborn, Michigan, actually. But if you look at how it's trading, that is trading actually more like a double B than a triple B. The rating agencies still have it a triple B. Internally, we call that a double B because where the market is pricing those bonds is not eligible for this portfolio, because we require not only the Moody's and Standard & Poor's to say it's investment grade, but that the internal rating, the way the market is pricing it, would be investment grade. But the other thing I will point out is the bonds are all denominated in U.S. dollars. But the U.S. has got the largest and most liquid corporate bond market in the world. Issuers from all over the world come to the U.S. bond market to issue in dollars. So it'll be, you know, corporations and banks from all over the world. They're traded, they're settled in U.S. dollars, they're settled on our system, our settlement systems here in the U.S., DTC. Those issuers might have local operations, for one thing, or they might just then translate it back to their home currency and spend it that way. But they might find it, because of the depth of our markets, cheaper to finance in U.S. dollars than in their home currency. So you'll see issuers, many issuers, from not domiciled in the U.S., but they are dollar denominated. And we will put limits by country of issuer as well.
So to get really specific, is Boeing in the basket?
That I would have to. I don't.
I'm wondering whether or not. It seems to me that there might be some. They're in a state of flux right now,
yeah,
in terms of their own cash flow, and I'm wondering whether or not something like that would be an attractive issuer, because they need something to get them over the hump, to get the planes back in the air, and do they need the money?
Well, what we, and I don't remember specifically if Boeing's in the portfolio, but I can tell you how we would look at Boeing. We would, you know, again, we could get. a lot of data on how Boeing bonds are trading. You know, actual, and these are not evaluated prices that some pricing vendor's thrown on there. These are where trades are actually happening. Buyers and sellers are meeting and agreeing on a price. Those are golden to us. So we would look at every single Boeing trade, not just in the securities that are eligible for your portfolio, 5 year and under, but the entire range of Boeing bonds. And you could get lots of data points, hundreds and hundreds probably a week. And then we would, every single one of those, we would take the price, convert it to yield, and map it out against a series of standardized yield curves, a AAA yield curve, a AA yield curve, single A, AAA. And then we would map it out and say, where is the market pricing this relative to its rating? If it's Boeing, I think single A rate, I'd have to double check. But if it's trading in line, well, then it would certainly be a candidate. Now, even in there, we may not own in the, it might be eligible for the portfolio, but we may not own it at this time. Maybe the last time we went to buy Boeing, the trader thought the price was a little rich, and he said, no, I don't like the level I'm getting. But that's how we would evaluate Boeing and every other issuer like Boeing.
And last, probably the classic dumb question, when Apple has as much as they do in reserves, why are they issuing bonds? Except perhaps, I guess, that they can make more on their reserves than it costs them to issue bonds.
Or activist shareholders sort of demanded a dividend from them. They went a long, long time without paying a stock dividend, and there were activist shareholders that said, and they were sitting on $125 billion in cash.
Right.
And someone said, you need to start paying a dividend. A lot of that cash was overseas, and there would have been a repatriation tax to come back.
Right.
So they said, fine, we'll issue bonds and pay a dividend out of the bond proceeds. That's more or less what happened with Apple.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Tim, I know you had mentioned as we were sitting just before in closed session about kind of market liquidity. I think Dave probably touched on that from Dimensional's perspective. Did you have any specific questions in the remaining minute or two that we might or might not even have
in terms of
market liquidity, anything directed or good enough?
I think, you know, the question really came down to, is the market as liquid as it had been in the past? I mean, your way of accessing liquidity differentiates from peers. Are they seeing the same depth of liquidity in the marketplace that we had maybe 10 years ago?
That's such a very timely topic, and that's all we talk about is in some ways. But here's my point of view. If we look at the size of the corporate bond market, it's $9 trillion. It's the highest it's ever been. So first thing I would evaluate, primary markets. Are issuers having difficulty raising capital in the capital markets? Absolutely not. If you look at new issues, they're oversubscribed 3 times, 4 times routinely. Bond markets at a size at an all-time high. If you look at daily trading volume, all-time high. So there are more bonds trading now per day than there's ever been. Now, the daily trading volume hasn't quite kept pace. It hasn't grown as fast as the size of the bond market, so the ratio of the one to the other might not be at an all-time high. If you look at, there are indices that measure bid-ask spreads, they're essentially at all-time lows, right? So if somebody told me that there was a liquidity problem in the corporate bond market, I would expect lower volumes and wider bid-ask spreads. We're seeing higher volumes and lower bid-ask spreads. What has changed in the market, this most significant change since the financial crisis, if all the bond dealers, the registered bond dealers, essentially have to report their inventories to the New York Fed, and that becomes public data, not by individual security, but by aggregate numbers. The amount that dealers are holding in inventory is a fraction of what it was pre-2008. And that sort of changed how the market feels, because prior to 2008, if you want to sell a bond, you'd call up a dealers and request a quote. Where would you bid this bond? You'd go to multiple dealers, you'd put in a competition, and they would bid on anything. Now dealers are far less willing to bid to take into their inventory, because for them the cost of holding inventory has gone up due to changes in their capital requirements. So the role of the dealer has changed over the last decade, where they're trying to essentially match up buyers and sellers in advance. So you're a seller's bond, give me a few minutes, I'll go see if I can find a buyer. Then essentially act more like an agent, where they'll just essentially just match the buyer and seller. It technically is a principal trade. It will go through the dealer and then the dealer to the buyer. So the amount of the time that the dealers hold on to bonds is much, much lower. So that feels different in the marketplace. But the market evolves like any other sort of mechanism, and markets are now figuring out ways where buyers and sellers essentially can go find each other Because if all the dealer is going to do is go match up buyer and seller, we figured out how to do that ourselves in an anonymous way. And we're seeing a tremendous amount of activity in these automated trading systems. We use the term peer-to-peer trading, where you know, buyers and sellers are sort of meeting in the central marketplace anonymously and saying, and not relying on the dealer to buy it first. So I personally think that liquidity seems different, but if in the major metrics like the average daily volume and bid-ask spread, it's pointing to very, very healthy markets. One last thing, and I'll stop on the topic, but because it's an ongoing battle, because they're literally in front of the SEC right now as a proposal to sort of made by this Fixed Income Market Structures Advisory Committee that the SEC formed to actually start to limit some of the transparency, particularly on large block trades, where now they're required to report the transaction within 15 minutes. The dealers, they don't like the transparency. When the dealer buys a bond, within 15 minutes, we all know what he paid for it. And they don't like that, right? They would rather keep that dark. And they're pushing back and trying to, for large trades greater than $10 million, you know, to delay the reporting by 2 days. We're in a period of 60-day open comment, and I promise you Dimension will comment very, very strongly our opposition to that, because we basically believe that transparency is good for markets. Transparency is good for all sides of the market, the buyer of a bond, the seller of a bond, the issuer of new capital. The only one it's not good for is the dealer, because now their bid-ask spreads have to get narrower and narrower. So that's yet to be determined. But I would argue that liquidity in corporate bonds is healthy, and markets are evolving, and I believe it will. If we could keep transparency, our markets will stay healthy.
Sorry, just one last quick question. Mm-hmm. To what extent, if any, is a default a factor in what you deal with for us? Have we had any bond
defaults? Never had a bond default. Default rates, I will say this, if you an investment grade, they're remarkably low. I mean, even on triple Bs, the historical default rate is less than 1%. It's almost zero, basically, in triple A, double A. But again, we're monitoring and those prices, and those prices will give you advance notice before ratings. So once the market thinks it's even a double B, it becomes a sell candidate for us.
Thanks.
Dave, you understand our structure pretty well, our liquidity structure. Yes. As you know, we have yourselves, SIT and INSITE. We put that together now approaching 3 years ago. Is there anything you would change in the way we now do it? If you could wave a magic wand based on what you know about what's happened between 3 years ago and now?
Well, I know what Ted would say.
Not necessarily.
If you look at what Dimensional does, you know, we cover the short end gov credit investment grade. You know, sort of what we hadn't been covering is mortgages. So I think SIT is a sort of a perfect marriage with a gov credit manager, you know, working in mortgage. And we understand their strategy, and that strategy works for them. I mean, so I think that, and then I think the sort of the completion manager, that's a little bit more out of my area of expertise. Of course, we're square in the middle of Tim's as far as like completing the portfolio for all the funds needs. But, you know, it's sort of like, we're all working in concert, but playing our own instrument. And it seems from my point of view, I think it seems to be working very well.
So you wouldn't change anything at this point from our point of view?
Other than more money for us, Ted?
Not even there. I'm not sure that I would say that, because it was interesting when we came in. I assume you all may remember that we all came in on the same day and presented kind of all together. First time in my 15, 20 years that I've kind of done that in terms of not competing against these other two managers, but together. And it felt really, well, it felt interesting and different, but it also felt like it made an awful lot of sense that it had already been kind of concepted. And frankly, Dimensional, we do serve a single manager role very well, I think, for many clients. But we also, given that differentiated, unique, whatever word you want to say, the fact that we're probably the only ones in the room who are, wait a second, you rely on market prices and that's it, with all the implementation, et cetera, that part makes us a very interesting complement to SIT, who's a very specific manager doing what they're doing, which makes them an interesting complement then to INSITE, who kind of puts it all together. So I would say that so far, so good, if it's meeting your all's needs, and it seems to make an awful lot of sense from ours as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The last thing, I'm just in summary, or I'm actually going to ask you to probably say a little bit more dimensional serving follow-on to, you've mentioned about liquidity, impact on a firm like Dimensional with this kind of change in liquidity versus those who might be seeking a certain mispriced credit?
Well, a couple things. I think if you're seeking immediacy on a large block, you're probably not doing as well. And I think most of them would have understood that and would have adapted into saying, if I have a large block, if I'm trying to move a $50 million block of, you know, Walmart, I might have to break that up into smaller trades. By the way, you know, the equity markets, that's exactly what's happened in the equity markets over the last 30 years. If you look at the average size of an equity trade, it is a fraction of what it was 30 years ago. Block, so now they're, you know, they're working in nanoseconds, you know, on 100 share lots is how these all algorithms trading. I don't know where we will end up. But we're sort of following the broad path of what the equity markets carved out. And bond markets being what we are, of course, we're running about 30 years behind them. But but the you know, we're seeing, we're getting the transparency that, you know, they've had for ages. We're getting the automated systems that they started about 20 or 25 years ago. We're getting to the peer-to-peer trading that, you know, and our average trade size is getting smaller. So again, I think these are all healthy developments, by the way. You know, when people ask me about, you know, market efficiency, and I say these are signs of very, very healthy markets, that prices are so good at reflecting information so quickly, that's nothing to be frustrated with. I think, why would we want our capital markets working any other way? I think it's a sign of a healthy market that information gets into price quickly and accurately. So I'm a bond market optimist. I think the markets are better than they've ever been and going in a direction that will benefit, you know, all participants in the market.
Great. Well, if no further questions, I want to thank you for your time today and for the ongoing relationship with Dimensional. And for those of you who make it up to Tahoe, certainly look forward to seeing you up there for the latter part of the week when I show up.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.